I may wear my hat for a little bit to celebrate my former orthodoxy. And it's an honor and a joy to be introduced by my dear friend whom I don't see enough in life, David Bojan, whose work I admire so much, truly admire. We live in this huge country. I guess it's still a country. It's nervously held together by the wrong fingers. And we don't get to see each other much. I remember from time to time when I went to Greece, all the Greek poets, they have their island. Each one has his or her own island where they live. Then they all have an apartment in Athens. It's a small place. Or it could be Israel or some other, you know, Jordan, Ecuador. I mean, the llamas write poems in Ecuador. And I've always envied little countries where you get to see your friends more often than we get to see ours. And it's a pleasure for me to be here. The last time I was here in any force was on the death of Larry Levis, whom we all know and love and celebrate. And Ellen Voigt, I'm looking at my clock only to figure out, hey, because as an old teacher, I know what the 50-minute hour means. So not to be nervous, I'm not Gary Snyder. I'm not going to go on for 3 hours. I'm not Robert Bly. I'm not going to say, do you want to hear that again? I love Robert. Where was that? Yeah, so Ellen and I came down here after Larry died. And students were in such shock, and some of them are here tonight still, I noticed. And we try to fill in his unfillable shoes by meeting his students and talking to them and nursing them a little bit, nurturing them a smaller bit. I'm so happy to learn tonight that Larry's presence, Mary, how did you say it was?
Street art.
They're nailing pictures, is it, of Larry with lines of his poems here and there. I treasure his memory more and more as the years pass. So many of us knew him well and loved him. And I had the privilege of spending a lot of time with him in what was for a while my home, Iowa City, and spending long, long evenings with him emptying bottle after bottle. So I'm gonna dedicate this reading, if I may, to Larry. And I'm going to read a poem for him called Eggshell for Larry Levis, 1946-1996. The color of life is an almost pale white robin's green that once was bluer when it was in the nest before the jay deranged the straw and warm flesh was in the shell. I found it while doing my 45-minute walk between two doors beside some bushes and flowers. I put it in one of my pockets, keeping some space around it to protect the pale green, an idiot carrying a dead child inside him, something that might have broken out anyway, a blue afterbirth shoved out of the nest. I laid my dead like eggs on the table, 12 tombstones to a box. I buried dread that way by telephone calls and letters. And on the way, I walked into a side yard and straightened a brick, for it was May, and chased a garter snake into his rain spout. And since it was morning and it was hot already, I put the eggshell under a leather chair and thought of our trip to New Orleans and used the end of a broom to prop up a rose bush the way we do, sweet Larry. I celebrated at the end there a trip we took together to New Orleans. He had never been to New Orleans. We were doing something in Baton Rouge. Larry would get excited. He would jump, Mary Flynn would remember, he would literally jump up and down. And we went to New Orleans, and I had the honor of having him write a poem about me on that visit in a graveyard. As you know, New Orleans, the graveyards are raised up because of the water. It's all bushes full. Everything is. I noticed in his poem, I was celebrating eggs that come, for whatever reason, or used to come, by the dozen. You know, why a dozen eggs? Why not 10 eggs? Now they've outwitted me, and you can get eggs that are 18 eggs, 10 eggs, 6 eggs. I'm pissed off. It ruined the poem. And I could just see these $500,000, $1 million CEOs sitting at a table saying, I got an idea. Yeah. Why do eggs have to come 12 to a box? Never thought of that, Gus. Why do they? Well, they don't. Well, you're going to get a raise. What's going to happen? You're terrific. So now they're making eggs, you know, you've seen them in the supermarkets. You can get 18 eggs or 15 eggs or 10 eggs. Don't be deceived, they're not really eggs. They're not chicken eggs anyhow. 12 to a box, be loyal. Be loyal to the dozen. So I'm gonna read you from 3 or 4 books, 2 or 3 poems from each, ending up with some new poems. And on the way in, I stole from the bookseller back there a book that I don't have with me. So let me read a couple poems from this long book, which is about, 75 years of poetry. How about I read a poem called Swan Legs? I always wanted to write a poem called Swan Lake, and I never could, always came out corny, until I was in a doctor's office and I read about Mao Zedong and second visit to Soviet Union, guest of Khrushchev, and he was in what used to be called Leningrad, and it described how Khrushchev took him to a performance of Swan Lake, and so on and so on. The other fact you should know is that swan was once an animal that we ate. And then during the American Revolution, it was a delicacy, or the time of the American Revolution. I mean, Washington, they just ate Hessians. They were terrorists. They crossed the Delaware River near where I live and killed these poor Germans celebrating Christmas, which was a kind of crime in those days. And they were singing, ya, 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 weiß nicht wie gut ich dir bin. And all of a sudden these terrorists started to kill them. And we celebrate that. We call it Washington crossing the Delaware. Just for a second, when Mao stood up and walked out of the theater in Leningrad, the swan stopped dancing. And Khrushchev just shrugged his shoulders and lowered his eyes. Mao's hatred of tutus prevailed, as his hatred of Russian food and his hatred of clean napkins. Nixon and Kissinger sat for the swan in Washington. They passed notes between them, and when they were finished reading, they tore them in tiny pieces. The swan believed in suffering, so she floated across the stage. Well, sort of floated, and so it goes. The pricks down there in their seats, they couldn't care less. They feasted on swan legs. They took care of themselves. Yet, why should I pick on them? There's enough feasting even without them. I usually know pricks. The swan is lucky for such a bird to do what she does to music, to do it to song, her head in the air, so misunderstood and hated, so wrongly loved. First her dark beak swaying, and that is a violin. And then her leaping, and that is the harp. The comb, look at me forgetting the comb and the sweet potato when I was a swan myself, and I almost floated. The one I remember, she sang and trilled a little. That was a swan with a voice. The thigh is wider than a chicken's. The flesh is dark and stringy. It was vinegar they forced down the throat. Plain, distilled, white vinegar to soften the wild flesh and kill the suffering. And I'll read one more poem from this book. There's one here, it's a love poem. What's the opposite of a love poem? It's not a hate poem, it's when you're denied love. That's gotta be a species of poem. What should we call that? Let's make it up. Loveless, lovelorn, hopeless, lonely,
unrequited.
Bitter,
unrequited.
Unrequited. Mankind is always unrequited. That's his fate. Unrequited. I didn't get my due. Hey, God. God sits on all the committees that gives us awards. We talked about that at supper. Not God. I have a book called Not God After All. I wish I had a copy of it here. All right, I'm going to read a poem called The Sounds of Wagner. So when I was 20 years old or so, I was 4F. I used to have bad eyes, and I got an operation a few years ago. Now I have good eyes. But when I was 18, 19, 20, I was kept out of the army because of my eyes. Finally, they admitted me when they lowered all the standards, when the war was over, you know, when all the sissies were going to the war and so on. My friends were all home, all the heroes, picking up the girls. And there I was going in with 18-year-olds and 17-year-olds and everybody laughing. But before that, I was a student. I was able to go to college because I was such a terrible student in high school because there were no men around at the time. And I saw a bunch of people on the lawn. They were doing something. It was Pitt University. What are they doing? Someone said, they're registering. So I could put two and two together. One thing I could always do is put two and two together. Five. And so I went up and I registered. I became a student. So I had a girlfriend. Her name was Doris. I won't tell you her last name. It's Borkin. She had a sister named Naomi, and her grandfather was a chief rabbi of Poland. She was supposed to marry a rabbi. She married a cello player. But anyhow, you know, in our culture, in Pittsburgh, I was a Jew then. I'm still a Jew, I guess. They say, once a Jew, always a Jew. That's what I hear. And, you know, from my culture, maybe other cultures are like, for all I know, the girls, they would go only so far. They wouldn't go all the way. You know what I mean by all the way? Not to somebody who was cognate. But here, one day I walked into the Carnegie Library listening room, and there was my love. I looked in this little mirror, and she was with a cadet, one of these GIs that was going to college at the time. Belonged to the ASTP, that's the Army Specialized Training Corps. The song went like this. Oh, some mothers have sons in the Army. Some mothers have sons on the sea. Oh, take down your service flag, mother. Your son's in the ASTP, ASTP. Your son's in the ASTP, TS. TS stands for tough shit. So there she was on the floor. You'll hear the poem. You could call him a lachrymose animal lying on his glasses at 2 a.m, remembering the photograph of himself ice skating on his uncle's farm, or eating hot sausage and buttermilk, or making a speech for Stevenson on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, or talking to Auden about Velveeta cheese, or standing for an hour in front of the Beacon Pharmacy pitching pennies, or climbing all day long above the Liberty Tunnel, or swimming by himself around the steel pier in his wool bathing suit. He loved lavender more than anything else and never forgot the sunsuit he wore, nor did he ever forget looking into the tiny window of a music listening room and seeing his darling fucking someone else on the carpeted floor, her earphones still intact, though his, her lover's, an Air Corps cadet, his hung askew, and the sounds of Wagner floated or scattered throughout the room and he could hear it. Nor did he ever forget his walk that day through the park and how ashamed he felt and bitter and how he weathered it. Yeah, she'll regret it. I'll show her. Doris, she's a dear woman. Her sister did marry a rabbi. God, I have 9 kids or something. That's all rabbis do is they have kids. That's not quite fair. Mormons do that too. I'm going to read some poems from this book. It's called, is this back there, American Sonnets? I'll read some poems. Anyhow, if there was an academic here, we'd get into an argument about what a sonnet is. I could have called these American songs. A sonnet means little song, and nobody would give me any grief. But it was, people were amazed, not counting lines and counting rhymes and talking about the turn and the summary. And I mean, Shakespeare himself violated the rules, the Italianate rules, and everybody has violated. George Meredith violated, Robert Lowell. I mean, that's the whole purpose of life, to violate rules. And I'll read maybe three poems from here. There's one called Winter Thirst. And these are poems I discovered after I wrote the book. They were all about Western Pennsylvania, where I come from. They're autobiographical, they're intellectual, and they're about the winter. None of them were about the summer that I can remember. I grew up with bituminous in my mouth and sulfur smelling like rotten eggs, and I first started to cough because my lungs were like cardboard, and what we called snow was gray with black flecks that were like glue when it came to snowballs and made them hard and crusty. Though we still ate the snow anyhow, and as for filth, well, start with smoke. I carried it with me, I know, everywhere. And someone sitting beside me in New York or Paris would know where I came from. We would go in for dinner, red meatloaf or brown choucroute, and he would guess my hill. And we would talk about soot and what a dirty neck was like and how the white collar made a fine line. And I told him how we pulled heavy wagons and loaded boxcars every day from 5 to 1 a.m. and how good it was walking empty-handed to the number 69 streetcar, and how I dreamed of my bath and how the water was black and soapy then, and what the void was like and how a candle instructed me. Here's a poem called The Ink Spots. That was a group that used to sing when I was a kid. I guess everybody knows who the Ink Spots are. If you have any idea, raise your hand so I know. Okay. Can you sing a song from the Ink Spots?
No.
If I didn't know why the roses grow, la da 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 da, so on, so on. Thing about the dove. It's about a city called Altoona, Pennsylvania. There's a horseshoe curve. It's called the Horseshoe Curve. And I could go on forever about why the Pennsylvania Railroad, it used to be called, but why it's there instead of where it should be. And it's got to do with the greed, selfishness, and criminality of the millionaires who bought up the land and owned the state legislature. But why go into that? See, I know the whole history of Pennsylvania inside. I'm the only one. The thing about the dove was how he cried in my pocket and stuck his nose out just enough to breathe some air and get some snow in his eye. And he would have snuggled in, but I was afraid and brought him into the house so he could shit on the New York Times. Still, I had to kiss him after a minute. I put my lips to his beak, and he knew what he was doing. He stretched his neck and touched me with his open mouth, lifting his wings a little and readjusting his legs, loving his own prettiness. And I just sang from one of my stupid songs from one of my vow decades, the way I do. I have to admit it was something from Trains. I knew he'd like that. Resting in the coal car, slightly dusted with mountain snow, somewhere near Altoona, the horseshoe curve he knew so well, his own moan matching the trains, a radio playing the Ink Spots, the engineer roaring. There's always a big discussion going on now about lucidity and obscurity in poetry, and I'm sure you guys go into it a lot here. And everybody has an axe to grind, or two. And those of us who write poetry, namely practically everybody here, are always happy when we discover a poem that we wrote that really doesn't make sense and that is good. I mean, you can write a lot of poems that don't make sense that are bad. You can open up Never Quarterly any day and read that. But what if you write a poem that doesn't make sense and is good? That's a delightful experience. I don't know why. So here's a poem that doesn't, I guess it, so I read this the other night and someone said, yeah, that does make sense. And I didn't ask him what it was about. But the first line of the poem was taken from a letter that a poet named Alexandra Lynch, do you remember her work? She's a good poet, wrote to me, and I'll read the poem. It's called Dandelions. I keep following the dandelion druff, and the call of the North Tower, which is what I want to say is one final thing after the hottest May and the coldest June I can remember. But what I want to say I can't find words for, which no one who knows me would ever believe. All those professors and janitors and salesmen and secretaries, not one could tell me if gruff is related to dandruff, though two out of four said Grandfather Lion made the motion of blowing the white seeds into the air and watched them float down, and three out of four said, "Ah, North Tower, the center of all existence, or the last outpost." But what I meant was rose hips. And what I meant to say was trees in a line, and limestone walls, or maybe just thoughtfulness instead, or even affection, or maybe sitting on the ground eating a cheese sandwich cross-legged in the white and seeded dandelions. I guess that doesn't make much sense. One more, how are we doing here? Okay, we're doing good, we're doing well. Here's a poem called Samaritans. We used to take high school trips. Everybody's taken high school trips. This was I think we were studying geology. And we took a trip, and our teacher was old and blind, and so we could, you know, make out in the bus or something. We used to always go to these primitive communities near Pittsburgh where they practiced some kind of fundamental communism. We had a lot of these communities. I mean, not the kind of communism that came later, but where everybody lived equally and nobody... They didn't cohabit, and the women lived in dorms and the men here, and they did furniture. I mean, different groups that did different things like that. There was a town where the Samaritans lived. You know who the Samaritans are, don't you? They were a group living in what is now called the Near East. I like that word. Sometimes it's called the Middle East, which is near the Near East. And Palestine is around there somewhere. And there was a group called the Samaritans. They're alluded to very often in the Christian and the Hebrew Bible, called mistakenly the Old and the New Testament. Jesus referred to the Samaritans. They were an accursed race. You've got to have an accursed race. Now, currently it's the Bangladeshi. But for a while it was the Irish. And then, you know, the Irish were so low in the 19th century when there was still slavery going on in this great republic of ours. There were signs in Boston and New York, "Irish need not apply." Do you know that? It was great to hate the Irish. I kind of liked it, and I was kind of sad when we finally elected an Irish president. And you could no longer hate the Irish. Then my son married an Irish woman, and he's half Irish anyhow. Jesus, what the hell did I get? That's a poem I'm going to read later about that. So we went to class trip. We visited the Samaritans who live in Ohio. I can't remember what the class trip was. I think we were going to visit the Samaritans who lived in round houses at the border of West Virginia. They believed in a round eye staring at God. Or maybe it was God who had the eye and stared at them. And Moses alone was the light, as far as they were concerned. And his was the only law they followed. Forget the other prophets, so-called. And how they got to West Virginia, I forget. Though I know our teacher, a specialist in sociology, was teaching a religion when we went on this trip. I think I got waylaid a little, the way it did then. It was spring and warm. The girls had on light dresses, and we had cigarettes. The chimney holes looked like eyes, but it was God's eye that I will never forget. It followed the bus back to Pittsburgh. And sometimes it seemed to smile, the way an eye smiles, though it was incorporeal, of course, and my own eyes were closed. I was sleeping. There are a couple of these sonnets there. I'm going to read this. I like to read one longish poem at every reading, and this is the one I'm going to read from the book that I stole back there. It's called 16 Minutes. I hope it doesn't take 16 minutes. And it won't, don't worry. I was poet in residence at a place called Bucknell, Pennsylvania, and it's in a town called Lewisburg. And there's a prison at Lewisburg. I drove over to the prison, and I was going to drive in, and I got a voice, just a voice. It wasn't God's voice on Mount Sinai. It said, don't go any farther. We have guns trained. I swear to God. So I turned my car around, and I went the other way. And in this prison, it was a white-collar prison of sorts. There were various prisoners who didn't kill people, but did, you know, spies. And I mentioned a lot of them there. Some of the prisoners in there, in that prison, were really political prisoners. The group of people connected with the Rosenbergs, the brother-in-law, and Alger Hiss was there. And Wilhelm Reich. Do you know who Wilhelm Reich is? He was a follower, he was a student of Freud's, and he came to America and he developed a thing, what was it called, the box. What was that book?
Orgone box.
A certain energy got into that box, and it was connected with orgasms, you've heard of them. And I knew people that were, who are devoted followers of Wilhelm Reich. I'm one of them. He was put in prison for not paying taxes or something like that. The reason they put him there was because the government didn't like the idea of the Oregon box. I don't know who was president at the time. And because it was too sexual, something like that. He died of a heart attack in prison. Well, really the poem, I'm in a parking lot, and there's two clouds there, and for some reason, one of the clouds looked like Ireland, and one of the clouds looked like Greenland, and that's how the poem started. Goes like this. There in the sky above Lewisburg were two land masses that looked so much like clouds that when two birds flew through them, they flew through livid chimneys and smoking hillsides. One was Ireland, and one was Long Island. Side by side at last, completely forgetful of the other two masses, one to the east of those islands, one to the west. I parked my car, as I do, at a deadly corner to watch them change or come together as one more landmass, or even to join the other continents they left behind in Walmart's cloudy parking. I noted everything, including the great salt ponds in eastern Long Island, including the dark blood all over Ireland, caused, as it were, by the sun. Wild ducks flew over one place and wild geese over the other. Crows, with strips of something hanging from their mouths, flew between them. I tried, without going to the library, to unravel the history. Especially, I thought of illegal landings. And I thought of the little white potato passing between them. Strange to think that they had different poets, so close they were together, and strange to think how it would be if ours were closer, or theirs were closer to us, or if they drifted together east of New York and west of England, or in the lower sky above this Lewisburg, east of Clarion, Pennsylvania, west of Bloomsburg, 3 hours from Philadelphia, 5 from Pittsburgh. Odd to think of the Jews and the Irish, too, how we married each other, how my own children have pink faces, how we hated each other, Jews and Irish, and fought each other, how the Jews were horrified by one thing, how the Irish were enraged by another, how the Irgun on our side and the IRA on theirs both battled English smugness and deceit, how they both saw through it, and how the English were appalled by them both. Not to mention the Irish down from Canada who settled in Queens, not to mention the mayor of Dublin, himself a Jew, whom I saw plant a tree in the old Sephardic graveyard on Arch Street in Philadelphia, I'm sure, who traveled from Jewish place to Jewish place and planted and talked and drank and told a joke, albeit wearing a top hat, not a derby, not a cap, the thing we had in common, certainly not a beret and not a yarmulke. The wind, our enemy, destroying a couple of counties in both good places. Me not wanting to see the world in shreds. Language, too, we had together. I would call it subversive. And spoke we still another tongue, and spoke we this tongue as gorgeous strangers. And theater, I would name theater. And comedians, and actors, and lightweight boxers, and singers by the dozen, and music of tears you might call soft from time to time, and blarney, a Jewish characteristic. Mostly, though, self-reproach. We couldn't help it. One cloud turned black and then the other. They were raking their own furnaces. There was a little crime, too. And there was the mother. We both sang, Mammy. How could we help it? Mammy, Mammy, I'd walk a million miles for one of your towels. Oh, Mammy. But God, we were different. Did I say how one cloud was different from the other? And how I sat there for 16 minutes till one island, then the other, fell apart? Truth was, they fell apart slowly. Truth was, a larger island came in view. I guess it was Greenland, or part of Alaska, had mingled with Siberia and carried it my way. I almost made a new religion in those 16 minutes, and a new language, Jewish, and a foggy city called Irish Aloyim. That would mean peace to the Irish. I say peace to the Irish, and I say peace to the Jews, and I say grudgingly peace to Greenland, and peace to the monster Siberia with Alaska in its mouth, and peace to the hills of Pennsylvania, and mostly peace to the inmates of Lewisburg Penitentiary, and to the Irishmen there we held illegally and Thornburg extradited as a last vicious act to make Bush smile and Queen Elizabeth chuckle. And Jimmy Hoffa, and the Berrigan brothers, and Green Glass the Rat, who checked his atom bomb in before they gave him a number, and Morton Sobel, who spent 20 years here because he kept his bomb in a cardboard suitcase underneath a girder on the Williamsburg Bridge, and good Alger Hiss, he came here for the air, and for the food. He had a cardboard suitcase too with a bomb inside it. And peace to that Irish Jew, Wilhelm Reich, who died inside his cage in 1957, and to the love he brought us, and to his exploding cells, and to the cloud that carried him up, and to the shawls we wore, and to our moaning, and to the stone walls we moaned against, and the moon we always kept track of, the moon that ruled our lives through all the killing and hounding we all but worshipped. Both cultures are moon worshippers, the Jewish and the Irish, and they both wear shawls. Jewish shawls are called talises, and so on and so on and so on. A lot of those names you don't know about, but they're all connected with the Rosenbergs. And I read an article in Nation magazine today, an old Nation I took with me in the train, and it was about Alger Hiss again. They're still digging him up, saying, was he innocent, was he guilty, and was there a pumpkin? You know, stuff like that. There's Alger Hiss. He is disguised as a bottle top, a bottle cap. I'm going to read from this book. It's called Everything is Burning. And David was kind enough to mention a poem called The Original Stern Country. I'm going to read a poem, another poem in this book called Stern Country. It's not derivative of Stern Country, it's just Stern Country. And since many of you are students, or have been students, or are studying or thinking about writing, I'm going to talk to you about the creative writing process in this short poem. How to teach. So listen carefully. It's also how to learn. For sleeplessness, your head face down, your shoulder blades floating, and aspirin is a last resort when death is threatening. Though lately I've experimented with numbers, and as for dreams, I've never been boring, and only once did I bite the arm of a woman sitting next to me, and I should be careful. She might have a handwritten poem or a memoir. Didn't I bite her arm? And aren't we both poets? Though I warn her that I make gurgling noises and twitch in both legs and make the bed jump. And I'm exhausted from looking at poems, and I don't care about her nuts and bolts. And she has to go to the wilderness herself and fuck the exercises. Let her get smashed by a Mack truck. Then she'll be ready to mourn. I I'm going to read a poem a little later about meeting a man on a train last year on the way to the Virginia Center for the Arts. I wrote a poem there. It's called Asphodel, and it's about selling flowers on May 30th. Puppies, you know, started World War I. You know, people stand in front of banks, supermarkets, and they sell puppies. They used to sell them for a quarter. I don't know what they cost now, because death is cheap now, or life is cheap, which is, it's like insurance. They call it life insurance. It's death insurance. I mean, you don't call fire insurance water insurance. So why would you call death insurance life insurance? It's because we lie. Because lying is our national pastime. And so we put an expert in lying in the White House. The greatest liar in American history. He's even greater than Johnson was. It's an interesting thought. I'm going to read a short poem about the Spanish-American War. Well, you know, I travel by air with U.S. Air, and all their agents live in Manila. So I say to them, you know, it's snowing in Philadelphia, I can't go, but, oh, yes, sir. And they never heard of snow. At the end of our negotiation, I say, I want to apologize for the Spanish-American War. And they say, oh, thank you, Mr. Stern. They have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, you read Mark Twain on the Spanish-American War, and he makes our current commentators look pathetic. He called us. He talked about the beginning of American imperialism, how we went to help, you know, the Filipinos, then had them get rid of the Spaniards for us, and then we turned on them. What the hell? It's an old game. We learned it from the mafia, or maybe the mafia learned it from America. Who knows? Anyhow, I don't know why I'm reading this poem. It's called Just Say Goodbye to Mother. No, it's called May 30th. There are two poems here. The reason I say goodbye to Mother is that's a song from the Spanish-American War. It goes something like this. Just say goodbye to Mother and tell her there's no other. La da da dee, and so on and so on. Yesterday morning, I was with a mother of a murdered soldier, a woman who parked in Texas outside of Bush's ranch. A group of us met on the steps of Congress, led by Congressman Kuchinick, called for the impeachment of the president. It wasn't even a mention of it in the New York Times or the Washington Post. And there were important people, and I didn't talk, but you know, there were people. Ellsworth was there, and Christopher Hedges, and some important ministers, and so on and so on. That's how you get the news in this country. It was the first official act because Kuchinick introduced a bill, Bill 333, calling for the impeachment for specific causes, which is an appropriate thing to do. It's mentioned 18 times in the Constitution, how to impeach a leader. And the last time we did this was 2 years ago, before the Democrats got into office in Congress. And there were 39 people that signed up. Now Nancy, whose picture is in my study, but it's coming down tomorrow, said, well, we got other business to do first. You know, I mean, what's to be done before impeachment? So I'll read May 30th, that little poem. I had to sit on the steel railroad tracks to eat my sandwich. And you understand, I wrapped it in wax paper, since that is as far as I went in preservation. And I remember my serial number, and I was an H. This stood for Hebrew in World War II. You were either an H or a C or a P. You couldn't be an A. I mean, H is a language. It's not a religion. The religion is not called Hebrew. It's called Judaism. The stupid government called it H. And I remember my serial number, and I was an H in case somebody murdered me, for that was the day we fanned out in all directions with puppies in one hand and quarters in the other, the photograph that of a corporal with his balls blown off. I have a poem called Golden Rule. I forget where I got the title, but I like it. Golden Rule. It means, you know, do unto others as you're supposed to. And it's for my blue jay in my backyard. All she wants is for you to stay away from her egg, and all she wants is for you to shut up when it comes to the three things she hates the most: justice, mercy, humility. She detests Jesus, and she can define what he is and was and wants to be while flying unbearably low by the one word, squawk. And that is why I pulled my straw hat down over my bald head, and that is why my orange cat almost died with fear, and why she won the argument with her big black shadow while resting only on one leg. That's the reference there in the last line is to two famous Jewish sages. And one was asked by a pagan, so-called pagan, can you explain Judaism in one sentence? While standing on one leg, that was it. And he explained the golden rule. Do not do unto others as you don't want to do. There's one version. There are versions. Do unto others as you don't want them to do. I forget what happened. Let me read a poem called Lilies. And this is another religious poem. I used to live on the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware River. Now I live in the New Jersey side of the Delaware River. And I lived right off of a route called 611, which runs from Pocono Mountains down to Philadelphia. And on Sunday night in the summer, there's a bit of a traffic jam, you know, 10-minute traffic jam, people coming home Sunday night back to Philadelphia from the Poconos, bitter and angry, caught no fish, it rained, their wives didn't, not with them anyhow. The reference here to Yehoshua, whom you guys call Jesus. You may remember those lilies of the field, they do not spin, da da da. Jesus was saying, don't buy IRAs. That's what he was saying, because God will take care of you. That's what it says. Those lilies of the field. One Sunday night, I got caught in Pocono traffic and sat there for 20 minutes, during the which, in front, a madman saw me in his mirror and leaped out of his car and running screamed, Dr. Stern, I followed your advice. I gave up everything. Thoreau was right. Simplicity. I was your student. The which, I stared at him. Cars were starting up again. But I no longer believed and had to leave him stranded. I love you, I shouted. Read something else. I would have pulled off the side of the road, but there was no shoulder there, and so I lost him, whatever his name was. I made a sharp left turn, and that was that. But what I owe him in his undershirt. How long his beard was then, his eyes were blue, his tires were bald, what Christ owes me. I read a poem about music called Shouldering. We were surrounded by buttercup and phlox, so you know what the month was. One of us had Sarah Vaughan in her inner ear, one of us Monk. Who put a table there, we didn't know, but we were more or less grateful, nor was it even chained to anything, and the eggs we ate were perfect. I cracked them on my head, as I always do, and shattered them with my fist. The grape tomatoes, which only cost $1 a pint, were almost acid-free. The tire was growing softer, but I was a veteran of real tires and bumper jacks. I even go back to steaming radiators. I could tell you things, I said to Monk. I walked 2 miles once with a half gallon of gas leaking out of an orange juice carton. In my solitude, he said, September song, said she. So I'm going to read some recent poems, and then we'll call it a day, a night. I'll answer a question or two if you want to do that. Maybe you'll buy a book, and I'll make a nickel. This book is coming out in, you know, takes an elephant's pregnancy for a book to come out a year. I wrote a lot about shoes. I don't know why. Do you remember a shoe called Tom McCann's? Anybody know about that?
Yeah.
I sold Tom McCann shoes, and when I was young, I bought them. They cost $4.99, and I used to always have a sore foot because they, you know, they're bad shoes. And I always thought that when you have a pair of shoes, you get sore feet. Had that for, you know, a month, and then when the shoes were broken in, it was okay until I graduated to Regal shoes for $5.99, and then my feet weren't so bad after that. But they used to have x-ray machines.
You put your feet in those eggs and they, you know, show, you got cancer. They see the perfect fit, you know. This was to be free of the burden of representation, to put your feet in an x-ray machine and thereby not only get cancer and not only get fitted up with a perfect pair of shoes, but thence to grieve how thin your bones looked, how like more like a bird you were than an ape, and how you mourned how huge your feet were, and you went to the machine, oh, every 10 minutes or so, and how that leather pinched, for it was more cardboard than cow, and how it was inevitable, the limping. It was called the breaking in. I wanted to tell you this.